Ms. Dickinson, Ms. Holthus, good to see you both. This is case number 51647, Ashton Cacho versus State of Nevada. Ms. Dickinson for the appellant.
Your Honor, if I could reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
Sure.
May it please the Court, my name is Sharon Dickinson and I represent Ashton Cacho. We all know children are different than adults. We know that from our own personal experiences, and we also know that from psychological studies, which show that children are more likely to be susceptible to outside influence. Children are more likely to make rash, impulsive decisions. And children are more likely to be manipulated by others than an adult will. The law also recognizes that children are different than adults. In Nevada, the legislature protects children in some ways, enacting laws to protect them from other influences. For instance, a child cannot purchase cigarettes till they're 18, they can't gamble till they're 21, and they are prohibited from being on a board of directors for a corporation. In the criminal area, a child under the age of 8 cannot be prosecuted for crime. And a child between the ages of 8 and 14, the state has to show, if they're going to prosecute them in juvenile court, has to show that at the time of the wrongful act, they understood the act was wrongful. So we all know that children are different than adults. But one of the problems that happened in this case is the state and the court forgot that. In this case, Ashton was charged with and convicted of 4 counts of lewdness with a minor and also open and gross and indecent exposure, which are gross misdemeanors.
Well, Dickinson, let me interrupt for a second. It appears as if at least part of the appellant argument has been conceded, and that has to do with the redundancy of the charges. I believe that the state essentially has conceded that they would agree with your position in that.
That's correct. Okay. One of those counts would need to be dismissed. However, what I wanted to point out to the court is that whenever there are allegations of a sexual nature and the allegations are made by a child, under the rules of the state of Nevada, NRS 51.385, procedures are a little bit different than if the witness had been an adult. In this case, Ashton was charged with the 4 counts of lewdness with a minor, and the child was a 7-year-old at the time, Chloe. And Chloe was his girlfriend, then ex-girlfriend's child, and the girlfriend that had his own baby also. Now, a time that these allegations arose were a time when Ashton had left his girlfriend, Greta, and she was pregnant. And when Chloe made the allegations, they were made through Greta, who by the state's own concession was a mess. She had drug problems, she was verbally abusive to her children, she had a lot of problems. The state also knew that Chloe's testimony and statements changed from the time they were first reported and the time they went to trial. Knowing that, what the state was required to do was to file a written motion under NRS 51.385 and asked for a hearing. It would be a trustworthiness hearing because the state knew he was going to have to bring in hearsay statements from other witnesses. The state didn't do that. Instead, what happened is the state allowed Chloe to testify, and of course she did not testify to all the statements she made previously. And then they brought in her mother, and in the middle of her mother's testimony, tried to get into hearsay statements, which the defense objected to. So they made an oral motion for a trustworthiness hearing in the middle of the trial and dismissed the jury. And the court held the hearing and decided that Greta could testify to some of the statements. But there's a problem with this. The problem is multiple problems with this. First off, under NRS 51.385, it's supposed to be a written motion, should be a pretrial motion, and the state should identify each and every witness who's going to testify to hearsay statements in every hearsay statement that they're going to say. And when the court has hearing, the defense should be able to bring in its own witnesses and challenge it. So you need to have some sort of notice. You need to be able to bring in your own witnesses. And most importantly, the child needs to testify. Because under the statute, the court can't decide the trustworthiness of the child's statement unless the child decides the child is competent. And I suggest that no one ever made a decision here as to the competency of Chloe. And that makes her testimony and the hearsay testimony tainted. It should not have been admitted in this case. Chloe was influenced by her mother. There's no doubt about that. The mother had many problems, and there was this situation of Ashton leaving when all of a sudden the allegations arose. There were several CPS workers that were involved, and there were allegations of neglect. There were allegations that Ashton had inappropriately touched her. None of these were substantiated. So there certainly were questions with the competency of Chloe, and that should have been addressed by the court in this hearing with regard to the hearsay statements. So there was a problem here with it not being in writing, being orally, not identifying the statements, and there being no determination as to Chloe's competency. Once the court decided that the testimony from Breda could be admitted, then all of a sudden the floodgates came open, and not only did Breda get to testify, Detective Mason got to testify to hearsay statements Chloe said. Linda Linford, Breda's mother, was able to testify about hearsay statements. Melissa Candle, Breda's sister, testified, and on it went, all without hearing. Now, what happened is the state argued that, listen, under NRS 51.035, we can bring in inconsistent statements. However, that's not actually true. Because before the state can do that, because this is a child, and because these are allegations of a sexual offense, first they have to have a hearing under NRS 51.385. That didn't happen. NRS 51.385 is a specific statute, so it takes precedence over the general statute. What should have happened here is the written motion should have been filed, the hearing, the court should determine the competency, the trustworthiness, then gotten into whether the consistent or inconsistent statements should have been admissible. Basically, hearsay evidence was coming in for all different kinds of reasons from almost every witness.
Assume for a moment, Ms. Dickinson, that we agree with that proposition. Was there not sufficient evidence otherwise to convict your client?
No, there was not. What Chloe testified to was two things. She testified that she had seen Ashton's penis at one point, and she testified that he had touched her one time. Those are the only two things she actually testified to at trial. And what she said was she was in her bed, actually in a rollaway bed in the living room, and he was also in there watching TV, and she was in the bed with her two brothers, and all of a sudden she woke up because he had touched her, and she said, under the clothes. And when she woke up and looked, he was about 3 or 4 feet from her, the TV was on, and he asked her where the remote was. He was looking for the remote control for the TV. I would say that her statements that she said at trial were insufficient to prove anything because they don't show any intent to sexually arouse him or the child. Obviously, he was looking for the remote for the TV. There's no indication at all that he had any intent whatsoever to arouse her passions, to do anything at all to her in either instance. So I would submit that they didn't prove this case. And if you bring in the hearsay statements, none of that's competent evidence to begin with either. And the child was not competent. I want to touch briefly on the problem with CPS records, which is an ongoing problem that we face in these types of cases. The CPS records in this case that involved the time period during which Ashton was charged of having committed these acts were withheld from the defense until calendar. And basically, the prosecutor said, well, you need to get an order. The judge needs to sign the order. However, the problem here is that this is exculpatory evidence. in the CPS records, when the children were questioned by CPS workers, they denied any type of sexual acts had occurred to them. And this was withheld from the defense until calendar call. And the defense was told that you need to get an order. And I think that's just wrong. That violates Brady. It violates due process. There needs to be a procedure where it is the prosecutor, when they obtain these documents, they need to immediately turn them over. And if they feel they need a court order, then they need to get it and give it to us as quickly as possible. I also wanted to mention two very egregious errors that occurred with regard to evidence. The state, I'll just say briefly, the state brought in evidence that Breda had been sexually abused as a child, and then in closing compared Ashton to her father, which I think is an extremely egregious comment to be made.
That wasn't objected to, was it?
I don't believe it was, but I think it certainly is plain air to say that she married a guy just like dear old dad. And also to bring out the fact that he had other children with other women. I think that was nothing but prejudicial. If I could reserve my time.
You have about 4.5 minutes left. Ms. Holtis?
Ask a question of Ms. Dickinson before she returns.
Sure.
And ask them, because I'm asking it, if you
I will. I'll give her extra time. I'll give Ms. Holtis some extra time, too.
I want to go back to the suggestion that there has been a Brady violation in this case. Because I need for you to tell me what I think is a pretty standard Brady analysis, and that is, was this evidence in your mind withheld inadvertently or intentionally? Obviously, you say intentionally. And when did you, at what time during the course of this proceeding, was it that you first would have requested this information, if at all?
Okay, I wasn't the trial attorney, so I'm reflecting back on what he did. My understanding from what I remembered in the reports is that they had noticed the CPS workers, and at that point they would have noticed them only because they knew about the fact that they had interviewed her, and I would assume that they at that point knew what had happened. I also think they would have known it all the way back to the preliminary hearing, because at that time Chloe was in foster care. So they had, I'm guessing they went through CPS to talk to the foster care mother. At what point the defense attorney asked for the records, I'm not sure, but under Brady, exculpatory evidence has to be voluntarily given.
So, I understand that, but I guess when you refer to exculpatory evidence, it leads me to another question. I do apologize, Chief, for taking longer than
I
offered. In this type of charge, this the nature of this sexual charge, it would not at all be unusual for there to be no evidence found. Would you agree with me in that premise? I mean,
I'm sorry, are you talking about physical evidence?
Yes.
Which is examined by
physical
the nurse?
Yes.
Okay. Yes, that's true.
Okay, and so what you consider to be exculpatory is just the perhaps inconsistent testimony of the children, correct?
Well, it was the fact that the CPS received a report, and when they investigated, the children denied anything happened, which all occurred before the allegations arose. So I guess it would be inconsistent. It's also they were interviewed separately, so it's clearly exculpatory whenever somebody denies a crime that occurred.
Thank you.
I'll give you an additional 2 minutes, so you'll have 4 minutes and 16 seconds for rebuttal. And Ms. Holtis, you'll have 17 minutes.
Okay, thank you. I guess starting first at the top, it's the state's position that the appellant has mixed and confused competency versus 51-385. There is a requirement that there be a 51-385 hearing held outside the presence. There really aren't any standards set forth for what we have to do, but simply that the court address the fact that these statements are coming in and make a determination that they're appropriately coming in, that they're reliable and guarantee circumstances of trustworthiness. In this case, as in almost every case I do now, at the beginning of the trial, I proposed to defense and to the court, 51-385 statements are going to be coming in. I would suggest to the court that we do it in this way. Rather than having a separate hearing, requiring kids to come into court under stressful circumstances, sometimes we have out-of-state witnesses, a whole number of things. Generally speaking, these hearings are met by the witness laying the foundation. And that includes all of the foundation, because in order to determine the circumstances of trustworthiness, you have to know where the kid's coming from, what the dynamics of the family are, and all of that really would come into play. So effectively, to do a full-on hearing, it would require us to have the child testify twice. So what I propose and what I've done in the past and what there was no objection to by Mr. Meningo or Judge Tagliati was, I'll take the child or the witness, in this case, the primary witness with 51-385 statements was Breda, the mother. I'll take her up, I'll lay the foundation, we'll excuse the jury, we'll then ask the rest of the questions, get the statements out, the court can make the determination whether it's appropriately going to the jury or not. At this point, there was no additional testimony sought by Mr. Meningo. I'm not saying whether he'd be entitled to or not entitled to. If he wanted to call other witnesses or if he wanted to argue that it was insufficient, at that point, the court found it was sufficient enough based upon what she had heard to come into the court.
And you're suggesting that this was done by agreement in this case where everyone agreed to that procedure.
And there was, and what I'm saying is there was a hearing conducted. It wasn't a separate hearing. 51-385 does not require a separate hearing. It does not require pretrial notice. 10-day notice is specifically only if your child is unavailable. If we know that she's not subject to cross-examination, then it's a different standard because there's different things that might come into play, different arguments they want to make, but only is written notice required if she's unavailable. Chloe was available. She was 8 years old, not seven. She was eight by the time she testified. There was no issue raised by the court, by the defense attorney, or anybody else that she was incompetent. She answered all questions appropriately. Her testimony was clear. It was concise. It was relevant. It was inconsistent. Yeah, we knew it was going to be inconsistent, which is why ultimately all of that stuff came in. Because just like children are different than adults, sexual assault cases are different than any other case we have. Because they are perpetrated on younger, more innocent children. They're one of the few crimes that occur repeatedly, ongoing before it ever comes in. You know, we have a robbery, murder, we've only got a dead person once. But children so often are molested over and over and over the course of time. They're embarrassed by what's happened. They're scared by what's happened. They don't disclose right away. They don't understand right away. And these abuses are over and over. So the fact that they're making statements to other people, that they've made them in the past, that has great value, and the courts have recognized and the legislature recognizes. And so we have 51-385. And there are plenty of safeguards in place for that to be done. We complied with 51-385. Judge Tagliati made a record, even separate and apart from 51-385. It's clear from the testimony, and unfortunately, you only have the bare paper, but when you had been there, there was a whole bunch of inconsistencies. We know that this child initially went to her mother based upon the evidence. Mom said, shut up, don't tell anybody, they're going to take you away. We had sisters testifying that at one point the child is crying on the stoop because mom is yelling at her that if she doesn't stop saying stop, because if she says that this guy molested her before, she's going away. And that's based on mom's history, and mom knows that, and mom's been through the system. I mean, it's a whole different dynamic. So we've got, you know, this kid saying one thing at the beginning, and then gradually by the time she's in trial in front of the people who have the power to take her away from her mother, she's minimizing. So inconsistent statements came in, consistent statements came in, and Judge Tagliati did a pretty in-depth analysis throughout, and eventually, and quite frankly, defense, and sometimes I wish the defense attorney that tried the case could be here, because Mr. Meningo, frankly, wanted all of these statements in as well, because they helped him to kind of get to the bottom. What was consistent, what was inconsistent, that the child at the outset had said three times, well, one time first, and then she realized mom wouldn't get in trouble, so she admitted that it happened three times, three different days. She picked Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, I don't know, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, but effectively in her head, it was certainly more than one time. She thought three times. She described fairly vividly at the time how it happened. A lot of those questions were gone into by Mr. Meningo during his cross-examination of all of those witnesses. With respect to the CPS records, that is a problem that we're having because we're caught between disclosure and Brady and privilege and confidentiality. And so whenever I get that, usually a lot of times if defense, now there was no secret in this, the kids were in foster care, Mr. Meningo's been doing this a long time, he knew that there'd be CPS records out there, he was free to have requested them. I request them basically every case because I know there's going to be something out there, and quite frankly, it's generally helpful to the state. We have nothing to hide, but we also, by office policy and by statute, we have to comply with the law, and the law says we can't just give that over. And so I have it in my file, and the reality is Mr. Meningo and I have been, we've been talking throughout. Anytime I find out anything, I call him and say, this is what's going on. This is what I have. This is what I know. He was certainly aware. There's no indication ever in the transcript, other than Ms. Dickinson's argument, that he ever felt like he was behind the eight ball, that he didn't know everything that I knew at every step of the proceedings. I interview a witness and I find out an ugly fact. My file is documented. That information is turned over to Mr. Meningo right away. I had told him prior to calendar call, which is generally due to case volume, for whatever it is, that's when we really sit down. The case isn't going to resolve. Let's see, does everybody have what they need for trial? We hadn't even officially gone together to compare the open files at that point, but I had called Mr. Meningo and said, look, I got these CPS records. You want them. You should have them. We just need to get an order from the court. As soon as Judge Tagliati orders it, I'll turn them over. We came in, told her. She had, in fact, had an order on her desk, hadn't gotten around to sign it. We made sure it was signed. I gave him the records at calendar call in open court. He leafed through them. They weren't a particularly thick packet. He's seen them a million times before. He never said, I need more time. At any point, up until the day that we started trial, he never said, I need more time. It was clear that his trial strategy, his opening argument, was based upon all information in those records. Any witnesses that were referred to actually testified. In fact, a couple of them were called by Mr. Meningo with no indication from him, no accusation by him against me for withholding anything or keeping any information from him. He apparently, throughout the transcript, never felt in any way, shape, or form behind the eight ball with respect to those CPS records. And where this intentionally withheld comes from, I can tell you as an officer, if I'm with intentionally withholding, I got no secrets. Quite frankly, from the state's standpoint, it'd be easier if it all just came out. If they could just submit orders to CPS and get whatever they want and stuff. I mean, we're just trying to play by the rules. But we've got no secrets, we've got nothing to hide, and we're happy to turn over anything that's out there. Indecent exposure versus the open and gross, we did concede that. In fact, at preliminary hearing, I specifically amended with the understanding that one was an alternative to the other. I would suggest that the indecent exposure be stricken and only the open and gross stand.
Do all four lewdness counts, should they stand, or is one of them redundant?
It's my position that viewing it in the light most favorable to the prosecution and giving the jury the deference that we should, that they all stand. Admittedly, there was some back and forth. It appears when all is said and done, two counts probably occurred the same day, arguably. Certainly there were at least three separate times following the genital area. The tickling on the chest, at one point she says, occurred separate. At one point she says it occurred during the time when he was showing his penis to her. Another time it was before he went down below. Certainly there's substantial evidence to suggest that those counts spent, and the jury was thoughtful. And in fact, I think at one point, it was Mr. Meningo himself said, there's no compromise here. In his argument, it was kind of an all or nothing sort of argument. And again, this is where it gets hard because you're looking at a cold record. You're not seeing how the child comes across and how it was, how embarrassed she would become when she told what happened in the little tiny bit that she told. And how the aunt said, when I overheard her on the phone, she said it had already happened two times before. And this was before the time in June when he had come over and spent the night there. Remember, June 20th is when he actually stayed over the night, and that was the night of the remote when the child got up. And so we had already had witnesses that were aware of two prior incidences that occurred in April or May. And this kid going to her mom and saying, he's doing this, make him stop, and her not doing it. And that's when it gets reported to Melissa as she's combing the lice out of this baby's hair. And she says, you know, Ashton keeps touching me and mommy won't stop him. She calls her sister, CPS comes in, oops, kids clam up, big surprise. It's unsubstantiated, which does come in. It was over a state's objection that findings by other courts came in, but that came into the trial. So every benefit was thrown to the defense in terms of the information that came in. And the jury came back and they judged all the witnesses and they had basically all the statements from everyone and they determined that there was sufficient evidence to convict him on all four counts, all six counts. But
isn't it our obligation based upon the standard of review here? In fact, you referred a couple of times now to the flat record. Isn't it true, and I guess I should ask Ms. Dickinson the same thing, isn't it true that on an abuse of discretion standard, we are actually forbidden from substituting our judgment for that which the jury was able to observe by way of witness credibility, witness testimony, and the assessment that they made overall? So don't we have to stay away from that, as you suggest?
That would certainly be the state's position, that absent something that's really wrong, that's what the jury does. That's why we have the jury, and we give them great deference. They were there, and they did what we asked them to do. Prosecutorial misconduct, I do believe every comment in that was invited comment. It was pretty clear if you read all of the arguments taken in total. Mr. Meningo began his opening argument, and I will just say for whatever it's worth that it is argument, and sometimes we do perhaps say things that some people don't, but we are trying to argue and you get caught up in the heat.
Talking about the opening statement or his closing argument?
His closing argument, I'm sorry.
So he only has one closing argument.
Right. But he opened it with, lies are like snowballs. I mean, that was the tone of his entire argument. What this kid said is basically a lie, and lies get bigger as they go down the hill, and he talked about the dangers of the lie and how poor Mr. Cacha was standing at the bottom. So anything that was said in rebuttal was really in direct response to that. And any of the comments that I made were certainly invited based upon his whole argument, because his whole argument was that Brady lied and Chloe lied and everybody lied. So yeah, I don't really have anything. I don't.
Justice Gibbons, or Justice Sid, any more questions from Ms. Holthus? Please then go.
Thank you.
Ms. Dickinson, you have 4 minutes and 16 seconds.
And Ms. Dickinson, I'm going to ask when you reach the podium that you would start with the question that I last asked of Ms. Holthus, and that is, given the standard upon which we tender our review, shouldn't we be very careful about trying to replace our judgment for that of either the judge or the jury in this case with respect to an abuse of discretion standard?
Your Honor, that is correct. However, your review would be based on competent evidence. So any evidence that the court finds was not competent needs to be put aside. And if the court finds the jury based their decision on evidence that was incompetent, which we suggest they did here on all these hearsay statements, and on a child who there was never any competency evaluation, then the court can go ahead and overrule their verdict. So in that sense, yes, I do think the court can. But as far as the prosecutor suggesting, if you could have seen her the way I saw her, you only see the written page, you know, I think that you would not be able to consider that. That would be the jury. I wanted to comment a little bit on all the comments she made about the defense attorney who's not here. And I want to point out to the court that we are all bound by the record. If the state wanted to bring in something else that supposedly happened off the record, a private conversation, they should have done that before they got here. We are bound by what's in the record. And what's in the record is Mr. Meningo objected to this procedure. She came out, the prosecutor came out, said, this is the way I want to do it. And he said, wait a minute, we may need to call other witnesses. He specifically objected. He pointed out to the court that more than one witness's testimony needs to be presented to establish trustworthiness. But he said he would agree not to object to statements that Detective Mason was going to testify. That's what he said initially. Despite his objection, the court did it the way the state wanted. When we got to Detective Mason's, he then objected to Detective Mason bringing in the statements because Detective Mason was just reading into the record all kinds of things. So when the prosecutor suggests to you that he did not object, he did. It's in the record. The other thing that the prosecutor talked about was the CPS records and referred to perhaps some private conversation she had with Mr. Meningo that's not part of this record. Mata, refer to you to page 159 of the appendix, and you can see that he had no idea what was in those CPS records, because during the first day of trial, he expressed surprise to Breda's substance abuse problems and problems she had with CPS.
But he didn't ask for a continuance.
He did not ask for a continuance.
This is where we, as much as I look with a real stringent eye at what the DA does in these cases, if the defense doesn't object or ask for something that they're certainly entitled to, it makes it very difficult to say that it's error. Please understand that.
Yeah, I understand that. However, I also understand that if he wanted to try to get those CPS records himself, he wasn't going to get them. The judge even refused to sign an order that he had sent over there to get them. She waited till she's talked to the prosecutor in court, and then she agreed to sign the order. So basically, it's a battle for him. And perhaps in this case, rather than continually battling, he was trying to keep the system moving, and that may not have been the best choice. However, Mr. Cascio shouldn't suffer when they withhold exculpatory evidence that the defense never has an opportunity to investigate, and then they know all the facts better than he does. I think that the prosecutor and the state have a duty to turn this over and to turn it over in a timely manner, and as we know, they don't. And that apparently is the pattern. With regard to NRS 51.385, as I said, we objected. It requires written notice. That never happened. And so we would ask that you reverse these convictions.
Thank you. Thanks to... Okay. I would just like the counsel's opinion on having not to fly to Reno, rent a car, and drive to Carson. Justice Gibbons is the one who really came up with this idea of not only do we come down to Las Vegas, but we've been over to Elko and to Winnemucca, and we're going to go to Fallon and Wendover, and we're going to we went to Sparks already, and yesterday we went to Bishop Gorman, and we're going to go to the Hebrew Academy on my behalf to represent to do cases. So, your opinion on this?
I couldn't possibly be happier.
And we're happy to see you. We're happy to come down here once in a while too.
So do we.
And we're glad to see both of you. You both do a fine job.
All three of us about 3 feet of snow in our front yards in Carson City.
So you're traveling south.
Right.
And Hank, this case will stand submitted on fine argument and fine briefs filed by these fine attorneys and good friends, both of them. That's it. We're in recess until next call of the court.